Welcome to the Pulteney Street Podcast. I'm your host, President Joyce Jacobson. My guest today is Steve Penn, Associate Professor of Physics at HWS and a key member of the team of researchers responsible for the 2015 detection of gravitational waves, which confirmed for the first time the existence of ripples in the fabric of space-time that Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity had predicted 100 years earlier. Penn has made significant contributions to the optical and suspension systems of the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory detectors, the instruments that registered the gravitational waves. For the landmark research leading to those detections, Professor Penn was recognized in 2017 with the prestigious and highly selective Breakthrough Prize Scientist Changing the World Medal. Later that year, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded for the detection of gravitational waves, a breakthrough made possible thanks to the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, or LSC, of which Professor Penn is an instrumental, long-standing member and principal investigator. Professor Penn previously chaired the LSC Coding Working Group, a subcommittee of the Optics Working Group, which is developing codings for future detectives. In 2019, he was elected chair of the LSC. Steve Penn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Now, I always start my podcast by asking an origin question. After your undergraduate and graduate studies at MIT and a postdoctoral fellowship at Syracuse University, what brought you to Hobart and William Smith Colleges?
So let me just say that my first postdoc was at University of Washington in Seattle. So I went across the country, and then I came back here. And during that transition from back across the country, I went from being in a nuclear physicist to in a transition nuclear and gravitational areas of research. By the time I came back to Syracuse, was working just in gravitational physics. And at that time, LIGO did not have the well-established credentials that it has today. In fact, a lot of people looked on it rather skeptically, like the idea that we would be trying to measure gravitational waves because they are so small is something that a lot of physicists thought we would never be able to do, and we were almost crazy for trying. And because this area was seen as so risky, there weren't many schools around the country that were willing to sort of take a risk on someone who was working in gravitational waves. And I was glad for the foresight that existed within the Hobart and William Smith Physics Department for recognizing that if gravitational waves were detected, that this would definitely be a field of prominence as we've now seen that it is. And so when I was looking around, this position was available and they liked me, and here we are.
I'm glad that worked out. We made the right call. Can you describe a little more what LIGO Scientific Collaboration is, how it works, and what areas you as a member of the LSC have focused your research on?
Okay, so there's the LIGO Laboratory, which runs the two observatories, and that's based at Caltech and at MIT. And then the LIGO Scientific Collaboration includes those institutions, but all the other institutions across the United States and around the world that are collaborating together to both make those detectors work, to collect the data and make sure that data is well characterized, and to analyze it and provide astrophysical results. So that collaboration now consists of about 1,300 physicists around the world.
No, that's a lot of physicists. And what areas have you specifically worked on in that area?
So I started out when I was brought in as a postdoc, I was given a challenge of looking at the mirrors and trying to make them very low noise. You see, the problem is that we are reflecting light off of mirrors in an interferometer, which is an L-shaped detector. The laser starts at the vertex, goes out each arm, and comes back and is joined again at the beam splitter that's at the vertex. And then any length difference between these two arms is our signal, because a gravitational wave should stretch one arm and contract the other. But even though these arms are 4 kilometers long, that tiny amount of stretching is on the order of about 10 to the minus 19 meters, which is 1/10,000th of the diameter of a proton. So the light that you're using only has a wavelength of 1 micron, or 10 to the minus 6 meters, and then you're interacting with atoms on the surface that have a diameter of 10 to the minus 10 meters. So you're talking about sensing a mirror surface constructed out of atoms, but being able to determine that surface to 1/1,000,000,000th of the diameter of its constituent particles. That's extremely difficult. And so any disturbances in those atoms will lead to noise in your signal. Well, we did solve those problems when I was in work that stretched from when I was a postdoc to my first years here at HWS. And so now those mirrors, which are about 35 centimeters in diameter and 15 centimeters thick, present to the interferometer basically a noise that is so low that we are unconcerned. But on the surface of the optic is a mere 7 microns thick of mirror coating that the light actually interacts with, and that has been a source of noise that has stymied us for the past few decades.
Wow. Well, yeah, as an economist, I have natural science envy at this point, because there's no way we could ever measure anything with that degree of fineness in economics. Beyond confirming Einstein's prediction, what is the importance of the detection of gravitational waves? What do they tell us about the universe?
Oh, well, gravitational waves provide an amazingly rich source of astrophysical knowledge. So, for example, we don't really know what the populations of black holes and neutron stars are. Why? Because black holes are black. And unless they are sitting in the center of galaxies and streaming in lots of matter, we really can't see them. And so we have to therefore rely on gravitational waves to understand their population. And the amazing thing is that we had an expectation beforehand about what the distribution of black hole masses would be. And yet the catalog of sources that we're now finding are showing us black holes that are in the sort of tens of stellar mass range. That's the population that we're seeing. And that was astrophysically completely unexpected. And in addition, we're looking at the population of neutron stars. And so our first neutron star detection, which was on the 14th of August in 2017, was a merger of two neutron stars, but it was an event which had been theoretically predicted, called a kilonova event. And this is where two neutron stars merge and in the process undergo a lot of nucleosynthesis. It had been a puzzle within astrophysics as to where the abundances of elements that were in the middle section, sort of the mid to heavy metals of the periodic table, had come from. And now we find that the most prominent likely source of these mid-ranged elements, like platinum and gold, for example, are through these kilonova events that we observed for the first time.
So it sounds like the confirmation of gravitational waves has had a real expansionary effect on the range of topics that the LSC can work on. Are there other ones that have now opened up since the detection that the LSC is working on, besides what you've just mentioned?
Other sources or other detectors?
Other topics or things that if you hadn't detected them, like, it wouldn't have opened up these other things to work on.
We've had a number of sources that we see as a goal of eventually getting to the sensitivity where we're able to see them. We haven't done yet a good job of detecting them because we still have to bring our sensitivity down. So, for example, being able to see a supernova that explode in a way that's not spherically symmetric is a signal that we should expect to see. If you can see pulsars that are slightly asymmetric, anything that is of complete spherical distribution, we wouldn't see. But a neutron star, for example, if it is slightly aspherical, and by that I mean if it has a quote-unquote mountain range on its surface. Mountain ranges on neutron stars are about a few millimeters tall because they are of nuclear density. But if they have that level of asymmetry, they should produce a signal. So those are another source that we would like to see. And of course, eventually, we would like to be able to see the stochastic gravitational wave background that was produced in the Big Bang. That's very important to us because currently, with electromagnetic telescopes, we can only see to about 350,000 years after the Big Bang. That's when the universe went from being opaque to being transparent. So when we look out, Penzias and Wilson did with their microwave telescopes, out at the microwave background, we are looking back in time, and we can only look back far enough to see the surface of that primordial fireball. We can't see inside of it. But gravitational waves readily pass through matter. And so you can see all the way back to the time when those gravitational waves were sourced, which was in the first second of the Big Bang.
I guess thinking back from you first joined the LSC in 1998, and how has the LSC's work both evolved over the past 20 years, and what do you see as coming up, say, over the next 10 to 20 years? I'm assuming that much of this has scaled up. I wonder if there's plans for additional building of the facilities, other than the fine-tuning of the instrumentation, or how much the research grant money has increased over this period devoted to these projects.
Well, there's three important aspects of the question that you just raised, which is how are we changing sort of as a collaboration? How do we change as far as our observatories, and how have we changed as far as the money? The last one is easiest to answer. The money has not been, you would expect, wow, we've discovered gravitational waves and, oh, we won the Nobel Prize, that the financial floodgates should open to us. And that unfortunately hasn't been the case, which is unfortunate. I would hope that we as a society would put more money into scientific research, but that has not been the trend recently. As far as a collaboration, since I joined the collaboration, there has been an interesting transformation, because if you have big scientific projects, you always have the choice, compete or collaborate. And this was a strong debate that existed within our collaboration as to which to do. We have a sister observatory that is in Italy called Virgo. There is a observatory that is being built and calibrated now in Japan called Kagra, et cetera. So there was a potential for there being an Australian observatory. So do we reach out and collaborate with these fellow scientists internationally, or do we compete and have a race to see who's going to make the first detection of gravitational waves? Gravitational waves are very hard to detect, and having multiple detectors allows you to do good triangulation to locate the location of these sources. So for that reason, and because it is, I think, in the spirit of modern science and the best science for tackling difficult problems to collaborate, I was a strong advocate of collaboration, as were many of my colleagues. And eventually that idea won the day. And so now, recently, in the past few months, we've signed the LVK Memorandum of Agreement that builds off of the LIGO-Virgo collaboration and brings in Kagra. And we will have another LIGO observatory that is being constructed in India. And so we are building a worldwide collaboration, which is really, I think, something that is important for the science. And it's also an important example for humanity to show, look, this is what we can do if we learn to trust each other and work together internationally. As far as detectors, right now we have been funded to do an upgrade to the advanced LIGO detector called A+. And I'm busily working because we have hard deadlines coming up for a down select of the coating materials. And we haven't quite gotten to the answer, although we do have some promising candidates. That will be an upgrade in the existing facilities. And then we are looking long-term at what we can do to build an observatory that will see all of space. And what I mean by that is right now we only see out, if LIGO is at its full sensitivity, to about 200 megaparsecs out in distance. We would like to see all the way out to the edge of the universe. Let's take it all the way back 13.5 billion years and see all the way out of the full observable universe. And to do that, we need a much more sensitive detector. And so the one that is being proposed that I think has the most promise is called Cosmic Explorer, which would basically take the LIGO detector and scale it up by a factor 10. So instead of having arms that are 4 kilometers long, it would have arms that are 40 kilometers long. And the design is still in the early stages. There is another detector that is being proposed in Europe called the Einstein Telescope that would have a slightly different topology, and that it would be, instead of being an L-shaped interferometer, it would be an equilateral triangle with 3 interferometers intermeshed. But the goal of both of these, and I'm sure that they will work together, is to eventually get a set of observatories around the world that can see gravitational waves all the way out to the edge of the universe.
When you say that, that's just fascinating to think about going to the edge of the universe. It just makes me think and wonder what you think about the idea of multiverses.
Well,
you didn't see that question coming.
No, I didn't.
It's better physical, I guess, in some
dimension also. I'm not a proponent of the multiverse.
Mm-hmm. This is it. We just have one universe.
Yeah. Well, there's one universe that we have the ability to sense. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
So be it. Fair enough. But probably more a question for the religious studies professors instead of the physicists.
Well, no, I mean, there are a lot of quantum theorists that mm-hmm. will debate whether the multiverse exists. Mm-hmm. But I think that Feynman said a lot of physicists understand relativity when no one truly understands quantum mechanics. And I don't know if I quite agree with that, but I think that we have a lot more to understand about quantum mechanics. And I think in the end, and again, this is pure speculation, but I think in the end, we are going to find that the multiverse is not part of our reality.
Well, I can certainly believe that. Now, you've been elected chair of the LSC. What will that entail as you take on that position? What, from sort of a day-to-day point of view, or what are the jobs that you have to do as chair of this giant coalition of scientists?
So let me clarify here a little bit, because the official title is I'm chair of the LSC Council. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the LSC runs itself in a sort of parliamentary system, with that parliament being the council, and of all the institutions, they all have a proportional representation of people that sit on the council. And then that council elects someone who would correspond essentially to the prime minister, and that person is called the spokesperson. The chair would correspond in parliamentary terms to like the speaker. That's the person that sort of runs the meeting, but is not the spokesperson for the collaboration, which means that I have to run the meetings and make sure that the operations of the collaboration have to do so smoothly. And so what is that detail? That details dealing with a lot of membership issues and issues of proper collaboration and proper, we have to coordinate the release of our scientific data and make sure that those papers are properly reviewed and everybody is getting their proper accreditation. And there's, you know, with any group of 1,300 people, no matter what they're working on, there are going to be issues and conflicts. And my job is to help try and resolve that and have our operations run smoothly.
Well, your job, that part of your job sounds more like my job now mm-hmm. as opposed to the physics part.
Yeah.
Do you have any time to do research outside of the LSC-related work? Is there any other research you're working on or would like to be able to work on?
Well, there are projects that I would like to work on within LIGO that I don't get a chance to work on. And, you know, I have worked on a lot of different areas within the sort of detector characterization and data analysis. The problem that arises for me is that, you know, I'm an experimentalist and I'm pretty good at what I do. And right now it is such a high priority for us to fix the coding problem that I've basically been told this has to be your only focus because, you know, we are stuck and we need a solution and you're one of the people that can help deliver a solution.
Fair enough. Fair enough. When did you know you wanted to be a scientist and why? Was physics always your field of interest in science?
Within science, physics has basically always been my area of interest. And I remember as a child, I had an aunt who bought me a series of Time Life books. They used to come like mm-hmm. once a month.
Yep.
And there was one that arrived, you know, they came on like the reptiles and the mammals, but there was one that came called The Universe. And I read that cover to cover, and I was just mesmerized by the big thinking. And, you know, I don't know. For me, it seems like everyone is enamored by the concepts of where did everything come from? How did it come into existence? How did it evolve into the state where we see it today? Where is it going? What is the universe comprised of? On the biggest scale, on the smallest scale, how does it work? Does it work the same everywhere? How can we possibly explore it? I mean, those are the questions that, you know, really get me fired up. You know, who can't look out at the night sky and wonder yep. about that?
That is great. Who are some of the scientists, either past or present, who have most influenced your thinking and research and why?
I would say within our collaboration, I'm going to point out three, and I'm going to point them out in the order in which people have heard of them least. One of them is Vladimir Berginsky. He was a professor at Moscow State University, and he was someone who, you know, he told me the story one day during a LIGO meeting about how when the Nazis were invading Russia, how he had to get on a train and sort of was, as a child, a refugee from that war and the incredible poverty that they had to live through. And yet he knew that intellectual pursuits were sort of going to bring him sort of an escape from that hardship. And he studied physics, and he went on to be one of the leaders in the early days of gravitational wave physics. But when you interacted with him, because he was a giant within our field, although he's now passed away, he was as personable and as gracious to everyone that he interacted with. And he had had this record for creating materials that are of the highest quality. And I remember when I passed him in making these measurements, and he came over and greeted me and sort of like bowed down and said, "Now you are the king of creating quality materials." Wonderful fellow. And he collaborated very closely with Kip Thorne, who I think many people think is basically the one of the intellectual giants within relativity. There is, you know, people refer to it as the Bible of gravitation. It's Meisner, Thorne, and Wheeler. It's a book that is measured in inches thick on gravitation. And he wrote much of that. And again, brilliant gravitational theorist, who also became scientific advisor on some of the science fiction movies later on, etc. But again, someone who was a wonderful colleague. And, you know, I would sort of model how I would like to interact with our junior scientists in the way that I see him interact with it. He had an interview once where he said, it is so important to scientists, even as they are aging and becoming senior in the field, to keep that childlike curiosity and to keep that childlike enthusiasm for all of the subjects that we look into. And then the last one I would say is Ray Weiss, who is one of the founders of LIGO, and still, you know, to the extent that he is able, he will always continue working on trying to sort of better this project. And he doesn't, even though, so here's a winner of the Nobel Prize, the founder of this project, revered by everyone, but when it comes down to it, he will do the dirty work that's necessary to keep that instrument running. Instrument design and characterization, and even to the point where we had a leak in one of the beam tubes and he completely walked through the tunnel the whole way in order to be able to find that leak himself. He doesn't put that off, even though he's clearly like the giant within our field.
It sounds like that's a common thread on the people you admire, people who are willing to get down and do the work as well as having this higher sense of what the work is to do.
Yeah, there is, within our collaboration, we strive to maintain a sort of equality intellectually. It's a challenge to learn to collaborate, but once you are able to do that effectively, it is incredibly rewarding.
Speaking of being down in the trenches, of course, we make you teach as well as do research at HWS. What's your favorite course to teach or favorite assignment that you like to give to students?
Well, if I could list a couple, I like teaching the advanced laboratory because I think that students really need to have a sort of hands-on physical sense of how the world works. And this is the laboratory that investigates the experiments that reveal quantum physics. And so I think that it's important to have a strong mathematical background and theoretical understanding, but you also have to be able to see, well, how does this manifest itself in the real world? And so you do experiments like pulsed NMR and looking at laser spectroscopy and even looking at how even if you put a single interferometer through two slits, or you have two slits that the light can possibly pass through, even when there is only one photon at a time passing through this system, you still get interference. And so this idea that you can see these concepts within quantum physics become manifest, I think, is an important educational tool. But I would say the other course that I really like teaching is extremely theoretical, and that's our advanced E&M class. That is probably the most theoretical, rigorous mathematically course that we teach, and I enjoy teaching that course a lot. I used to teach Introduction to Astronomy before Leslie Hebb joined our faculty, and that was also fun because you could take students out to the telescope, and they could see for the first time, you know, what do the planets look like? What does a globular cluster look like? I mean, they've seen the night sky, but until you see it through a telescope and reveal some of those wonders, you know, the first time that they see a galaxy, that's also quite fun.
I heard that you used to reenact Galileo's Tower of Pisa experiment around Halloween each year using pumpkins. Could you describe that experiment and what students are supposed to learn from that?
Well, it's important to make sure that physics remains fun. And so part of that is you try and come up with events that sort of teach an important lesson. This is supposed to be a very public and accessible event. So you're just reenacting Galileo's Tower of Pisa experiment. And you do it on Halloween because pumpkins, everyone loves pumpkins, especially when they're frozen in liquid nitrogen. And if you can also do it from a great enough height, you not only get Galileo's experiment, but you get a little bit of sonoluminescence. So when the pumpkins smash, they actually give off a little flash of light if you're careful to catch it just at the right time. The unfortunate thing at HWS is that we don't have any tall skyscrapers in the middle of campus like we did at MIT, where the pumpkins are thrown off every year from the Green Building, which I think is 23 floors high. Mm-hmm. So we actually had a physics technician a few years ago who made us a crate in which the pumpkins could be stored, and then you could remotely release the bottom of the crate to allow the pumpkins to fall. And he tied helium balloons up to allow them to float, and we tethered them. And so we could almost get to that 23 stories and then release them. That was I have the film. I can share it with you at some point.
I think I'll need to see that later.
Yeah, it was spectacular.
Wow. Oh, just one question that I reminded me of from an earlier thing you said. What's your favorite science fiction movie and why?
My favorite science fiction movie.
I always feel like scientists have a higher bar on those, like the science actually has to make sense for one thing.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know that I have a favorite science fiction movie because there are science fiction movies that I will watch and, you know, maybe watch more than once, but I haven't found a science fiction movie in which the lack of science doesn't bother me on some level or another.
That's sort of like when I watch movies about economics, that's always a problem too.
Do they make movies about economics?
Yeah, sure. Other people's money. There's one.
Okay.
Trading Places. There's a famous trading scene in that. As you know, we are in the process right now of planning for a new science facility at the colleges. What do you think a project like this can enable here? Things that maybe we aren't able to do now, but that we can do if we build a new science facility?
Well, it has a great deal of potential, I think. Part of the potential is that when we build a new science building, it will be a statement to everyone who comes to campus, including prospective faculty, that we are serious about the sciences. You know, if you show up and your buildings are not as well maintained as you would like, then that sends a message. And when you build a new science center that is state of the art, that also sends a clear message that you are serious about it. And that means that we have the potential to bring in good junior faculty. If you have good research facilities, that says, you know what? Teaching is important and research is important. You're judged on all of them for your tenure, but we aren't going to make sure that even once you pass tenure, you have the facilities and the resources you need, because our scientists doing groundbreaking research is important to the colleges. And I think that's a clear message that we would need to send. And it sends a message to prospective students, because look at the job opportunities that exist. Look at how everything going forward, no matter what the field, is permeated by advances in technology, advances in science. There's a much higher level of scientific proficiency that is going to be demanded of our culture and our society going forward. And we have to be able to teach that. And in addition, we are located in a prime area where we have around us resources that we could exploit in order to be innovative. I think it's important going forward for us to show that we are going to contribute intellectually towards solving the climate change crisis. We have a resource. We have a huge thermal bath called Seneca Lake that is very near us that we should make use of, like Cornell makes use of Cayuga Lake. And coming up the lake, we have great wind currents that we could capture. We could set an example in sustainable energy and energy distribution issues, plus innovations in science. If we did if we were incubating new technological businesses that our students and faculty are able to develop, that can only aid the economy in Geneva. And all of that, I think, primarily has its source within the fields that teach science and technology learning. So I think it could be an incredible benefit for the institution.
Okay, well, I'm excited too. And finally, I ask everyone this question. What is the one thing you want me to know about or explore at Hobart and William Smith Colleges?
I think what I would say is that what I would like you to know is not just the level of scholarship and quality of teaching that exists here at the colleges, but I am hoping that you will realize the full potential of teaching, but most especially scholarship, that can exist at the colleges, and to have conversation with those people that are pushing the fields of scholarship forward in all of the different disciplines, and talk to them not just about what exists, but the potential of what could exist. Because we have to keep in mind the goal when we're setting our trajectory for the future. And I think that bar can be set pretty high.
I think one of the things, you know, we just have joined the Association for the Advancement of Liberal Arts Colleges, and I think that is a group of the 25 top liberal arts colleges, which now includes us, taught from the sense of schools that care about research as well as teaching. I think I'm trying to send a strong signal that I see the two as inexorably linked if you want to be a top school. Well, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts to me. This was just fascinating, Steve, and thanks so much, and enjoy your winter break.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.